This spring, WBEZ presents Patti Smith in conversation with Jeff Tweedy, Anita Franco, Patrick Radden Keefe with Gillian Flynn, and more. See the full lineup and register at wbez.org/events.
Chicago, I'm Mariah Wolfel in for Sasha Ann Simons, and this is In the Loop. Don't forget to stick around to the end of the episode to get the latest news around the Chicago area. But first, the idea of American citizenship is on many of our minds as we continue to see aggressive immigration enforcement by the federal government. But citizenship is exactly that, an idea, one that was constructed by people not native to this land, and one that has changed over time. So what does it mean to be an American citizen, and who gets to be an American? Local author Daisy Hernandez explores those questions in her new book, Citizenship: Notes on an American Myth. I sat down with her and asked what it was like to be writing about the idea of citizenship at a time when the Trump administration was escalating its violent deportation missions in American cities, including Chicago.
I was finishing it around the time of the election, and but I grew up in an immigrant family, right? So my dad's a political refugee from Cuba, my mother's from Colombia, I had tíos from Peru, from Puerto Rico, friends from Mexico, Argentina, Guatemala. So I like to say I grew up in the United Nations of Latinos, located in New Jersey. So I've been thinking about citizenship since I was very young. And I was a child when, in 1986, Congress actually granted a pathway for citizenship for 3 million people in the United States, mostly Mexican. And I was really interested in how did we go from that moment to 40 years later, this violent persecution of people. And so this book gave me an opportunity to look into that history and to see that citizenship has not been one fixed status. It has dramatically changed over the history of this country. And that's what I explore in this book.
Mm-hmm. And did you ever feel at moments like, oh, I gotta get this out here. People need this information as citizenship becomes such a national conversation?
That's a great question. I think as a writer, I was so in the book that it's not until I finished it that, and until the election results, right? I think if Trump hadn't won, we would be having a very different conversation about citizenship. Once that happened, I did receive questions from people in my life who said, you know, is it safe to put out a book like this right now, especially as we started to see in 2025 what Trump was doing? And I decided that I needed to go forward with the book because the rise of fascism always wants silence from us. And so I wanted to do my tiny little part in battling to keep democracy alive in this country.
Mm-hmm. And this book weaves in so much of your family story, which you just kind of mentioned. How did your family's story, your mother, your father's journey to the U.S., and then your upbringing shape your understanding of citizenship, especially, you know, at a young age?
Yeah, when I was a toddler, my father would pick me up, and in Spanish, he would ask me, are you Cuban, Colombian, or American? And I learned before I could really speak that the third option was the one that I should tell him, Americana. A lot of syllables, so I didn't necessarily get them all out. But as I grew older, I began to understand, and obviously in working on this book, understood even more deeply, that my citizenship here was possible because of my father, because there was an open door policy in the United States for Cuban political refugees in the 60s and into the 70s and 80s. At the same time that in 1965, for the first time, the United States actually put numerical limits on the number of Latinos that could come to the U.S. And so while it was opening the door for Cubans, it was putting limits for everyone else. And in the late 70s and into the 80s, actively deporting people from Haiti. So I consider my citizenship to only be possible because of the kind of U.S. imperialism in the Caribbean, the involvement that it has in Cuba's history and present moment. And but also my citizenship is based on the exclusion of others.
Mm. Let's talk about the subhead of the book. Citizenship is a myth, the overarching thesis of your book. one of the arguments you make is that citizenship is really just a guise to allow for racist, sexist, or homophobic policies. I mean, you could expand that those categories too. When did that start to become a reality in America, that citizenship was this tool for racist policies?
Oh, from day one. Mm-hmm. That's a great question. From day one. when I looked back at the history, it was amazing to see that as early as 1790, Congress said you can only naturalize as a citizen if you're a white immigrant, a free white immigrant at that time. Less than 100 years later, we had the Civil War to abolish slavery and to determine the citizenship of Black Americans. Shortly thereafter, we had the Chinese Exclusion Act, which ended up really barring everyone from Asia itself. So in the early 1900s, a woman could lose her own citizenship if she married a foreigner. We've just changed the terms of citizenship over and over again to meet the political moment. But I do want to remind readers through the book that in the 20th century, with the civil rights movement, the gay liberation movement, women's rights, we also saw an incredible expansion of citizenship, mm-hmm. of what sometimes in sociologists will call social citizenship. So protections against discrimination in housing and education and medical care, you know, all of that meant that, you know, we wrote the story of citizenship as much as people in power did over the years.
Yeah, I really appreciated how your book breaks down these three kinds of citizenship that we could categorize that larger bucket: civil, political, and social citizenship. And that really expanded my understanding of what we should or do expect from our citizenship, depending on where we fall on the levels of citizenship we have in this country. I'm just wondering, can you kind of explain what social citizenship is and how that plays a role in Americans' lives?
Yeah, and this idea goes back to the sociologist T.H. Marshall, and he saw social citizenship. He was specifically looking at England, and he saw it as a rise in the 20th century to refer to, you know, do you have access to a doctor? Do you have access to housing? Do you have a good job that provides for you? All these other aspects of life that are beyond whether I'm able to vote or not, or whether I'm able to own property or free speech. But really, I think at one point he called it the life, the civilized life. And so a lot of what here in the U.S. now we would refer to as a situation of racism or socioeconomic barriers, things like that, when we talk about that, we're really talking about social citizenship, about what kind of, how easily can I see a doctor? Do I have the money to cover my rent this month or not? You know, as a woman, do I feel safe walking down the street? Do I feel safe from sexual harassment? A lot of this can fall into that bucket of social citizenship.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I appreciate so much your storytelling in this book. You blend stories of your past, background stories of major players in American politics, and the history of immigration law in the United States just so beautifully to explain some of these concepts. One example of that is you talking about looking for treatment for a condition, a rash that you had on your face that you, as a kid, called the lizard for months. Can you talk about how you explore citizenship and healthcare through this childhood story of yours?
Yeah, when I was in middle school, I woke up one day. It was probably a very severe case of psoriasis. Didn't know that at the time. I just felt like I was turning into a reptile. And my parents worked in textile factories, and we did not have access to health insurance for most of my childhood. So my mother took me to a health clinic that she'd heard about through a friend in New York City that didn't care if you were coming from New Jersey, didn't care if you had citizenship, didn't ask a lot of questions, just your income level. And the doctor there was very earnest, but could not help me. And so we had to wait until we could pay out of pocket. And I was really conscientious as a child that I had some kind of medical condition, because we tried everything else. We tried the aloe vera plant at home. We tried the home remedies, and nothing worked. And I watched my mother paying cash, as I write, to save my face, literally, in that case. But it did make me think and wonder about the origins of healthcare in this country, mm-hmm. and how did we take care of people back in the, you know, 1800s, in 1776, when we're like forming this country. And it was amazing to dig into the work of just some amazing historians who've documented how often, it was the poor relief fund in the community where you lived that was expected to take care of you during that time. But fast forward to 1996, when we dramatically changed the parameters of citizenship in this country. So in 1996, we passed, Congress passed legislation, a lot of people know it as the Welfare Reform Act. And for the first time, it said that, you know, people with green cards who for so long had been treated as citizens in waiting is how one legal scholar refers to them. But in 1996, Congress said, no, you don't have access to Medicaid as a green card holder until you've been in the country for 5 years. If the state wants to use its own Medicaid dollars, that's fine, but you're not using our federal monies. And it's the first time that limits were put on that social citizenship, right, of green card holders. And so it meant that by the years later, when I'm interviewing this mom whose baby was in the NICU and I'm asking her about her insurance, her answer to me is, I don't have the 5 years. Right. I haven't been in this country for 5 years to access Medicaid. And when I sat down and I looked at the map of what is possible in the United States if you're undocumented or if you have a green card but don't have these 5 years, it really depends on the state that you live in and what kind of medical care that state is providing. So it means that we, in a lot of ways, are citizens of different countries, that if we live in California, we have a very different experience of medical care than if we live in Alabama or Tennessee.
Mm-hmm. It was such a history lesson learning about all of these different pieces of legislation that have excluded, you know, quote unquote, unwanted people from coming into the country, from the Chinese Exclusion Act. You know, you named some of them, to what you and other scholars have called the 1996 Latino Exclusion Act, to laws allowing the U.S. to deny entry to gay people up until 1990. Why was it important to include so many details about the ways in which the U.S. has legislated citizenship over its history?
For me, there were two reasons. The first one is that this is not the history I learned in K through 12. And even in college, it was kind of information that you had to seek out, right? So it was important for me to learn that history myself, to be able to contextualize my family and my experience within that larger history. But I think the second reason is because a lot of what we're experiencing right now traces back mm-hmm. to these laws. So if we look at this Latino Exclusion Act, this law in 1996, it really laid the groundwork for conflating immigrants with criminality. That's when you really see sort of this social policy coming together to emphasize that. And there was another law that was passed at that time that basically said, regardless of whether you're a green card holder or undocumented, you know, if you pled guilty 10 years ago to stealing a video game, we can deport you now. That had never been the basis for deportation. So we got here today in a certain journey, and I wanted to be able to trace that and show that it didn't just happen today. It didn't just start with Trump. We have been laying this groundwork for decades.
Mm-hmm. Going back to just citizenship being this myth, this story that politicians can tell based on, you know, what they want to see at the moment, how are we supposed to move forward knowing that? Like, what do we do with that information?
We can start talking about neighbors and friends and family members, which I think we're already doing. But when we go out there and we say we're outraged because the federal government is killing citizens, we unfortunately emphasize that somehow that is different than killing someone who doesn't have citizenship or targeting someone who doesn't have citizenship. So I think just in terms of how we speak to one another, it's really essential in certain ways to talk about our neighbors, our families, our friends, and to emphasize that we don't want any government that is going to execute people regardless of what documentation they have.
I want to talk about colonialism and
Let's do it.
Idea in your book, quote, "We are here because you were there." The first chapter of your book ends with this invitation to start wondering what it would mean if we, you know, recognized the United States as an empire whose political members are to be found across the globe. Can you talk about that concept?
Professor Achume at UCLA, a legal scholar, has been talking about the fact that given how empire works and that the United States has been so involved in the inner workings of so many countries, you know, citizens of, let's say, Guatemala are not exactly foreigners. So I took some of her ideas and started to apply them to the United States context. And I realized, yes, you know, the United States has been so intimately involved in the day-to-day workings of Colombia, absolutely of Mexico, of so many Caribbean nations. So, you know, how are you not a citizen if, you know, so much of your life has been dictated by the foreign policy of the United States?
Mm-hmm. Can you talk about how citizenship requires and or sustains white supremacy?
Yes, that's a great question. So for so long, we've used it as a marker to only to create a basically a white country. So very famously in 1924, we passed legislation, Congress passed legislation in 1924, saying we're going to place numerical limits to ensure that this country would remain white. And at that point, they were very concerned not with Mexicans. They were very concerned with people coming from Italy and from other certain parts of Europe that they did not deem to be white enough. The relationship with Latin America is also really fascinating because even right now, present moment, they're not targeting Mexicans who have fair skin and blonde hair, right? They're targeting people who have some kind of ancestry that's indigenous or black, that's racially ambiguous. And when we look at the 1930 census, which is the only time that the census counted a nationality from Latin America, that's what they were saying, okay, Mexicans are racially ambiguous. I mean, that's what they were counting. That's who they were counting at that time. So yes, we have been very committed. And, you know, right now when you look at what Trump is doing, he's identified 19 countries for which they have paused immigration applications, green card applications, naturalization, everything, asylum claims. When you look at those 19 countries, 10 of them are on the African continent. And then there's Haiti, Cuba, et cetera. So I think that reveals to you a lot, right, about the sort of, you know, the focus on white supremacy. And of course, when we look at the refugee programs that he decimated, where in 2024 we had a cap of 125,000 refugees. Now it's less than 8,000. However, he started a refugee program for white Afrikaners from South Africa. So we can really see both how the past is very much alive today in terms of keeping white supremacy alive.
Mm-hmm. In the book, you write so much about your primo, your cousin, who holds very different beliefs than you, despite on paper similar identities. You're both queer, your families hail from outside the U.S., but he is a Trump supporter and, for instance, doesn't understand your partner's non-binary identity that you write about. In the book, after narrating so many conversations you have had with him about politics, you write, "I began to wonder if public calls for civic engagement, for building bridges across political divides, were a way to avoid grief around the loss of relationships like that sometimes." Where do you stand on that question?
Yeah, I've had to think about this a lot, but for me, it's not a question anymore of political divides. It's a question of morality. These are moral decisions that we're making. For me, a political divide is, should we raise taxes? Yes, no, by how much? We have $2 million. Should we invest it in a small business initiative, or should we invest it in a school and for school teacher salaries? Those are political divisions and questions and debates. But I don't think that it's a political debate about whether our government can execute people, you know, in our communities. That, to me, is a moral decision that we're making. There's a right and there's a wrong. And so I think we have to start acknowledging that, because so much has been that we have to reach across the political divide and understand one another. But, you know, that was not true when we needed to end Jim Crow. And that was not true when we needed to stop the lynching of Black Americans and Mexican Americans. We stopped all of that, even though people wanted to continue it.
Mm-hmm. That in mind, do you think that this book has the power to shift the thinking of people like your cousin? And is that even the goal of this book?
I do not think this book would change my cousin's thinking. He told me so before I wrote it. he actually told me, this book is for you, not for me. He said, you're the one that needs this book, not
right.
me. And I think that was right. I think I needed to understand the history of citizenship. I needed to understand how we got to this point, to understand my family's journey in it, to understand how I wanted to show up as an American right now in this moment. So I do think this book is for people who need to understand the moment that we're in and how we got here and who want language to think this moment through.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to end on a sentiment that you actually end on in your book and share throughout the book, that citizenship is a story, but it is a story that has been and can be rewritten by the actions of the people in this country who work together, who organize. Is that what keeps hope alive for you?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. My hope right now is kept alive by all the amazing people who have shown up when ICE and Border Patrol showed up in our cities. Absolutely. And what I write in the book there, too, is this reminder that we've reached this moment as well, in part because we've had amazing social justice movements in recent years. So young people, undocumented youth organizing their families and their communities, that was an incredible moment. The trans community, the increase in visibility and their rights, I mean, that was also an incredible moment in recent history. And so I also see the political moment that we're in as a backlash to that. But it means that we were successful, that we expanded the bounds of social citizenship enough to trigger such a reaction.
Well, thank you so much. Daisy Hernandez is an associate professor at Northwestern University and author of the new book, Citizenship, Notes on an American Myth, an absolute must read if I say so myself. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
To the big news of the day. At the table to break down the biggest headlines and stories, Lisa Labas, WBEZ anchor, and Cassie Walker-Burke, WBEZ senior editor of Arts and Culture. Lisa started off with the latest update on memorial services for Reverend Jesse Jackson.
This is the big story of the next, you know, today, tomorrow, the next week. There were some memorial services over the weekend, people gathering to remember the legacy and life of the Reverend Jackson. But now the public really gets its chance to pay their respects. So visitation starting in about an hour on the south side at Rainbow Push headquarters. This is at 50th and Drexel at the headquarters. And it's going from 10 a.m. until 10 p.m. I would expect it is going to be extremely crowded. So many people wanting to say goodbye, pay their respects. And because of this, Chicago police have closed a few roads around Rainbow Push. You've got East Hyde Park Boulevard and East 49th Street closed on Drexel. They're closed between East 49th and Hyde Park Boulevard. And then on East 50th Street, that's closed between South Drexel and South Allison. This is going to stay in place mostly all day until, late tonight and then again tomorrow.
News you can use. Thanks on those road closures. Cassie, your team had a great profile about incoming Chicago Symphony Orchestra music director Klaus Makala, who officially takes the reins in the fall. WBEZ contributor Hannah Edgar got to spend some time with him at one of his favorite Chicago spots. Can you tell us more?
I sure can. So the CSO announced Makala's hire in 2024. He actually fully takes the reins next fall.
Okay.
And so this is a 3-year runway for somebody who...
I feel
who,
like he's just been here forever already.
Well, he just turned 30. Oh. I mean, this is remarkable. I mean, this was one of the 30. Big news stories in the classical world when it was announced. And he is really sitting on a perch that is one of the top cultural appointments in the entire world. So it was really fascinating. You know, we've been wanting to spend time with him. He comes in and out. He flies in. He has these weekends here and then he leaves. We are seeing him in town more. And so our contributor, Hannah Edgar, spent time with him at the Art Institute because he is an art lover.
Of course.
Of course.
I feel like he's a cultured, person. It makes sense. You know, artists love other people's art because you get to appreciate, that creative process.
He says his parents, he's Finnish, and his parents, as a child growing up, his parents are classical musicians, but they took him to museums wherever they toured.
Okay.
But I love this for Chicago because this is somebody who's coming to run really our I would say, our most prominent international cultural export. And he's already spending time in other cultural spaces. So what will that mean moving forward for our cultural institutions to have this sort of connecting of the dots? I am very excited to see it.
He's like an ambassador, you know?
Well, I love this and that he's a young person who has this interest.
You're thinking maybe potential collaborations or something like that when you have leaders of certain cultural institutions crossing with others and visiting right away.
Correct. And I think that the way that the arts speak to each other, but sometimes we see, just especially right now with this grab for audiences and funding, you know, we hear so many things about the crisis in the arts, but to see collaboration in the arts and the potential for collaboration, I think is actually really exciting for a city like Chicago.
I think I want string quartets in the Art Institute here and there, you know, like in front of a nice Monet.
We're going to have to send over all of our ideas.
Okay. Lisa, in another story, it looks like too many Americans are getting advice for what's best for their health from someone other than a doctor. What's happening?
Yeah, so the Chicago-based Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics did this survey and said that one in three people, fully a third of people out there who responded anyway to the survey, say that they use artificial intelligence to create their own nutrition or weight loss plan. I don't know if this is a good thing or bad. I don't know. But one dietitian nutritionist we talked with in Naperville says there's really no guarantee the information that you get from AI is backed by science. So, you know, really recommends you talk to a professional with credentials.
I feel like one of the reasons people do this is because our healthcare system is hard to navigate. So they turn to social media, but then that might not be the best thing for them either. What do you think, Cassie?
Well, we're getting so many conflicting messages also from Washington. You know, is steak, should that be at the top of the food pyramid? I have to say my son did this. And what was interesting, my son's 14, and what was really interesting there was that what AI spit out wasn't so bad, but what was very troubling was that he had put in a 1,200 calorie a day restriction that he had gotten from the internet as a growing 14-year-old boy. Mm-hmm. So I think that we have to be so vigilant, and not just as parents, but I think just as people and for each other, because really you can quickly go down a dark path.
Right. I mean, that kind of begs the question, which would you trust more, AI or an online content creator like a TikTok influencer for health advice?
Well,
should we be asking that question at all?
Well, I think in this case, it was the double whammy that was troubling. And so I think it's how do you as a person find, you know, the right kind of path here?
Where do you guys get your health and nutritional advice from when you can't get it from a doctor? Or do you just wait until you can see your doctor?
I mean, if I waited till I saw my doctor, it's really hard to get a doctor's appointment these days.
Yeah, it is.
And, for me, I'm a vegetarian. And so I've had to do a lot of research on my own. Mm-hmm. But when I do finally get to see my GP, I do talk very directly about my diet because I'm not getting some things in meat.
Yeah. I'm looking for primary sources online, too, if I see something on TikTok. There's so many health departments and organizations with trusted resources online.
I still like a book.
And I think that, you know, as we're all trained journalists here, so, you know, anything you see online, I'm skeptical of anyway. You know, and if it's something benign, like if I'm asking AI to tell me which is going to be better for this muscle ache, ibuprofen or Tylenol, that's one thing. But, you know, hey, can you interpret this like extensive medical test for me? And I'm not going to do that, you know, so it just... I don't know. A healthy skepticism, I think, is important.
Yeah. Lisa, yesterday, Chicago Public Schools officials laid out the changes they want to make to Chicago High School for the Arts next year. What do we know about the changes?
Okay, so it's the little that I know. The Sun-Times reported that there was this big meeting recently where, Chicago Public Schools said, we're going to change the way your day is structured for these students. So right now, students at Shy Arts who have to audition to get in, they take 5 hours of academic classes and then they get 3 hours of conservatory time where they're, you know, painting or they're singing or they're playing violin or whatever it is they're doing. But now, under this new potential structure, Chicago Public Schools says these students will get 30 minutes less of that conservatory instruction, and they're going to embed those lessons throughout the day. So not like one big conservatory block at the end of the day. Parents not happy is my sense.
Yeah. Do we know anything more about how they're feeling about this, or, you know, what their concerns are?
Cassie, did you have thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I think that parents are concerned because I think this has been a calling card of this high school. And right. Did you ever see Fame? Remember Fame?
Yes.
I mean, this is in New York. The Performing Arts High School is like a linchpin of city education. There's, you know, a great one in New York. There's LA. This was Chicago's. And I think that any sort of effort to what parents see as erode that education, because it's a choice. Nobody's forced to go to Chicago, you know, this high school. This is a choice school. And so, you know, if you're choosing to go there, you are choosing this for your child.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And parents said, you know, changing it. One parent was quoted in the Sun-Times saying, making, you know, the conservatory part kind of an after-school program, giving them an option for extra conservatory minutes does not keep it shy arts. So this isn't what they signed up for, really.
Right, you know? Right. Lisa, what other stories are you following today?
So other than the Reverend Jesse Jackson, we heard of a jury awarding $5.7 million to a family that was targeted in a botched police raid on the South Side. But this was almost a decade ago in 2018. So SWAT officers went into the home of Ebony Tate and her family. They didn't knock. They aimed guns at her children. They forced their grandmother outside, who was not wearing a whole lot of clothing. She was in her underwear. Lawyers for the family argued that this was part of a widespread pattern of unchecked excessive force by police. So the Sun-Times reporting the police department has since reformed its policies. And now this family has been waiting a very, very long time for kind of resolution on this. And now this jury is awarding them this monetary amount.
Okay. Cassie, we were talking about the CSO earlier, just to jump back to that institution. Few musicians ever get the high of performing with a full orchestra, but I hear a certain Whistling Fiddler will get the chance.
Indeed. So Andrew Bird, the Lake Forest native, who of course is, you know, well known for albums like The Mysterious Production of Eggs, you know, he is going to be performing with the CSO in the fall. The CSO announced that this week. And this is a bit of a, you know, a teaser for the full season, which the CSO will announce next week. And again, you know, talking a little bit about Klaus Makala earlier, mm-hmm. we're sort of excited to start seeing what his influence is and sort of bringing in these sort of different shows, types of performances.
Awesome. Well, we'll have to follow up with you as he gets the reins next fall. Thanks so much, Cassie. WBEZ's Lisa Labas and Cassie Walker-Burke.
Thank you.
This episode of In the Loop was produced by me, Micah Yasin, and edited by Ethan Schwab. Sasha Ann Simons is our host. For more in-depth coverage of news and culture in Chicago, be sure to subscribe to this podcast. For a full archive of the show, head over to wbez.org/in the loop. Thanks for listening.